On May 5th, 2006, the New York Times ran two stories. Patrick Kennedy crashes car into Capitol Barrier, and then, several hours later, Patrick Kennedy says he'll seek help for addiction. It was the first time that the popular Rhode Island congressman had publicly disclosed his addiction to prescription painkillers, the true extent of his struggles with bipolar disorder, and his plan to immediately seek treatment. That could have been the end of his career, but instead, he says, it was the beginning. Patrick Kennedy is a former congressman and youngest child of Senator Ted Kennedy. He details his personal and political battle with mental illness and addiction in his new book, A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Congressman Patrick Kennedy to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Joe.
What brought you to want to write the book? You have said that you were looking to do this not too far after you started sobriety, but you felt you had to wait a little while.
I had the great honor of writing the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act when I was in Congress, along with my colleagues, Jim Ramstad, my dad, Pete Domenici, named for, of course, Paul Wellstone, as well as Pete Domenici. The law very simply says brain illnesses, mental illnesses, addiction, alcoholism needs to be treated the same as other chronic illnesses. Now, what made this so surprising that this isn't already the law of the land, you know, when I was starting it, was that there was great shame and stigma associated with these illnesses. So even back in the early days of our fight to get this law passed, we would do hearings around the country, and family after family would tell a story about their loved one who died of these illnesses because they had gone untreated, mostly in the case of these hearings, because they didn't get the treatment they needed. The difference today is that's at least no longer on the books, discrimination. That discrimination is no longer allowed to be continued. But it doesn't mean that people are going to treatment. So what we still have is the challenge of people getting over the attitudinal barriers that keep them from getting treatment for mental illness and addiction. So that is really one of the great policy battles we have, is to get people to self-disclose if they have one of these illnesses. And obviously, if they don't have the self-awareness to disclose, then to have their family members feel that it's okay for them to get treatment for their loved one. So I wrote this book to really spotlight this challenge, not only on a policy level, but understanding that changing our personal attitudes will also change public policy.
But to the point of when you decided you wanted to write it, obviously the book details your own struggles with alcohol and drug addiction. And so you're coming up on 5 years. So there was a point where you wanted to wait a little bit because, well, as you say, once an addict, always an addict. But you wanted there to be a little time first.
Well, I wanted there to be a little time. I also, you know, dove into starting these foundations, one of which is One Mind for Research, accelerating neuroscience that's often fragmented, just like mental health is fragmented, and then the Kennedy Forum. And I knew I wanted to kind of, if you will, keep a diary of those efforts, because I felt both of them are critical to our future as a nation and our strength as a people. If we can better understand how the brain works, and if we can better apply that understanding to the delivery of health care to treat these illnesses, this is the game changer for us. And I wanted to kind of write a diary of my experiences, trying to coalesce people around trying to get to these challenges and the pitfalls that you would face if you were seeking to do so. And of course, while I'm doing this, I am embarking on the longest period of continuous sobriety that I've had in my life. And it may not be that long, but for me, it's marks a major departure in the old pattern of my addiction, where I would, in some cases, be able to put months together, even up to 2 years at one point. A lot of that was because of court-ordered supervision. But, never have I on my, not on my own, but because of the support of my 12-step group and support of my family and my God, have I been able to get the kind of sobriety, continuous, uninterrupted sobriety that I have today. So, I needed to do all of this in its proper time and place, and I felt that I struck the best balance I could. I know this is a really, really important time to change public policy. We've been faced with a series of tragedies, not only these recent shootings, but of course the epidemic of suicide in this country and twice the rate of homicide, yet we don't do anything really meaningful to really interrupt that epidemic. And of course, overdose is, climbing to 42,000 Americans a year dying of overdose. And of course, it's millions more who are suffering in silence. It's just shocking that we haven't evolved as a nation in our thinking enough to make sure we do better by treating these epidemics that are really ravaging this country.
Patrick Kennedy is our guest on the roundtable this morning. His new book, A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. In 2006, there were two stories that came out that you crashed a car into a Capitol barrier, and then just a few hours later that you said you will seek help for addiction. Prior to that crash, how close were you to seeking help?
Well, I had been in treatment for nearly 10 days over my Christmas vacation. So I figured no one would know if I went away and basically got treated physically for my OxyContin dependence and addiction. What ended up happening is that I didn't follow medical advice. I didn't get treated in a broader sense. I just got detoxed. And so 5 months later, is when I got the rude wake-up call that, it's not simply about, eliminating one drug. It's eliminating all drugs, because what we do if we have the disease of addiction and alcoholism is we substitute, other chemicals or alcohol for other addictions, and then the addiction goes on. So I had substituted Ambien and Phenergan and, of course, alcohol, thinking that, well, these are legal and, they're not OxyContin, and so it must be all right. And, of course, it's never all right if you're feeding your addiction. So it was inevitable that I would have more problems. That's the nature of a progressive illness like addiction.
You write in the book about how you started to drink at 13 as a kid. But it wasn't really out of the ordinary, because that is what your family did.
Well, I don't suppose that I can speak on behalf of all families, but I don't think there's many American families where alcohol isn't ubiquitous. I mean, we can't turn on the television without seeing ads for hard liquor. I mean, that was actually inconceivable up until just a few years ago. Everything is about drinking in our society, from sporting events to, family events to everything. And that's just in general in our culture. So my family was not unique in that circumstance. And of course, having alcohol in the house, as everybody's family usually does, if you have a genetic predisposition to these illnesses, which I had, because it runs in the family, just like, cancer runs in the family and diabetes and cardiovascular disease and the like. Then if you're higher risk and then you mix it with the early exposure to alcohol and drugs, then your brain becomes wired for that experience and it becomes harder for you to get into a place where you don't rely on drugs and alcohol to help you with life's challenges. So, yeah, I learned to cope through chemicals and alcohol, you know, early in my life, and it was therefore hard for me to shake it through the rest of my life.
You talk about your father and his battles with alcohol, and to the point where you had an intervention with your father, and he turned you away. He didn't want to see you for a time, and I guess what struck me in the book is thinking of losing two brothers to assassination, of coming to terms with that, and I guess ultimately what you did as well, of self-medicating to get through the pain.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, in terms of the intervention, it's uncharacteristic for people when confronted to deny they have a problem and moreover to push people away that say that they need to get help. That's pretty customary. That's all part of the common struggle. In terms of self-medicating, I mean, my uncles weren't assassinated. They were murdered and violently. You know, when we use that word assassination, it just... It takes the personal dimensions of this out. It makes it a political act as opposed to an intensely personal tragedy that is incomprehensible. And the impact of that trauma on my father, on all of my cousins and the rest of my family is incalculable. And yet we never talked about it. And that's one of the things today we know is destructive. If you don't address trauma, then it goes and it manifests itself in a very ugly and negative way in your life because self-medicating is a spiral. So the answer, as we know today through the science, is that it is important to talk about it. But of course, we didn't, and I think that added to the struggle that you know not only my father had and my mother had, but all of us had.
The new book is A Common Struggle. It is by Congressman Patrick Kennedy, former congressman of Rhode Island. A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. Your brother, Ted Kennedy Jr., older brother, has said that he feels that the book paints an inaccurate and unfair portrayal of the family. And this is something that you put in the category of this Kennedy code, that this is something you are not supposed to talk about. So I'm curious as to where you got the and fill in the blank, but let's say courage to talk about it when it was very clear that was not what you were quote unquote supposed to do.
Well, I was blessed, Joe, because I was given the opportunity to become the accidental author of a broad and wide-ranging modern-day medical civil rights bill, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. That put me in the place where I was seen as a leader in this advocacy movement for mental health and addiction, which is frankly very anemic when you can put it against the burden of illness that's out there and the number of people affected. There should be a lot more advocacy than there is today. So I couldn't go out there on the one hand and say, but beat up insurance companies because they're honestly not implementing the law, which requires them to cover mental illness and addiction in the same way they would any other physical illness. You know, I can't do this and ignore the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room is not only in our family's living room where we don't talk about these issues. It's in our nation's living room where we continue to ignore these epidemics of untreated mental illness and untreated addiction. So the big challenge we have is to speak out. And I can't say it and then not do it myself. And so I feel myself, I feel that I'm very lucky in my own regard to be able to have this opportunity. It's a very freeing experience. I really believe that for my children's future, that this is essential, and that I'm doing something intensely personal, and that's trying to protect my children from this family illness.
Does it surprise you that the family feels this way, given that it has been talked about in public and whispered about and gossiped about for decades, and especially in your particular family, going back to Chappaquiddick?
Well, it is something that it seems like it's revealing to talk in the way that I have in my book, when, in fact, I have the benefit of being able to go to any bookstore in America and look up my family and read everything that I've written in this book already published. You know, it's actually, it should be easier for me to name it for what it is and to talk about it, because, well, yes, it's, you know, talking about the family secret, in a sense, it isn't a secret. And if I can't talk about it when everything's already been written about before, well, then how can someone from any family in America expect to step out and do something that is very difficult, and that's to try to change the family conversation around these illnesses? So it's a difficult thing for me to have done, but I can tell you it's probably a lot easier for me to have done it, even though it's been difficult, than it will be for a lot of other families. But at least let's try to get the conversation started in whatever way we can.
Do you, and you touch on this, and I'm just curious as to, I mean, obviously you have the extreme situation of the family that you come from, but as you say, this is something that all families, certainly most families, grapple with. And I'm curious as to, did you come up with some understanding in the years that you have been sober as to why that is something with such transparency in our lives now, and with so much available, and quite frankly, so much of us turning a spotlight on ourselves, of why this is really the last thing that we can't seem to, one of the last things that we can't really seem to talk about, and that's mental illness and alcohol and drug addiction.
You know, it's a remarkable thing. You know, look at how quickly we've moved from the days of don't ask, don't tell because of your sexual orientation, you know, and yet the don't ask, don't tell policy, in essence, as applied to the space of addiction and mental illness, is alive and well. We don't want our physicians, we don't want our family members or anyone else, our teachers, to ask, and we don't want to tell. And you know what? Just as it did with denying our brothers and sisters with varying sexual orientation to keep them from coming out and being themselves, in the same sense, this denies the people from being able to get what is, you know, part of who they are treated such they don't have the kind of challenges they have because of the untreated mental illness and addiction in their lives. You know, silence equals death in the HIV AIDS movement. And it was because if you were dying of AIDS, you did not want anyone else to know about it because the shame was so great. And that made it more fatal to people with HIV AIDS. And with addiction and mental illness, not talking about it, not getting treatment because of your shame, also is a fatal aspect of this illness. It makes it more fatal for those who don't talk about it and don't get the treatment. So it is surprising. This is the last kind of medical taboo that the, you know, everybody just refuses to treat as a chronic illness like it is.
Patrick Kennedy is our guest. The name of the new book is A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. The two final questions I have for you. One is, your mother did help you with this project. She did assist you.
That's right.
And I assume that was very important.
You know, my mother grew up in an era where these really were looked upon as character flaws, not chemistry issues, as moral issues, not medical issues. And I really feel she had the double injustice of not only having an illness that was very difficult for her and for all of us, but also having the added injury of not having that illness treated as an illness, but then have her being relegated to this pariah in our family. And I think she suffered much more than she needed to because of that attitude. We have to break that attitude. That attitude leaves a lot of people still to this day to suffer in silence more than they need to suffer. And my mom is dedicated to changing that. And I really applaud her for that. She's paid an awfully high price for the silence and the stigma that she had to endure because of her medical illness.
And as we end our conversation, your relationship with your father when he died, were you pleased with the tenor of that?
I was so honored to have had the chance to work with my dad as a colleague in the Congress. To actually, one of the final things we did officially was watch as President George W. Bush signed into law the legislation that both of us have been the principal sponsors of in both the Senate and the House, the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which was both a political triumph for me as well as a kind of a personal triumph that I had that closure with my dad, that he actually saw the value of this as an important medical civil rights issue. And I'm blessed to have had that relationship with him. And of course, we had a much deeper personal relationship because we lived next to each other. We worked in the same building, so to speak, and we got to see each other so frequently. I have great, great gratitude for the relationship I had with my dad.
Patrick Kennedy is the author of the new book, A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. Patrick Kennedy, a great pleasure and honor to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, I appreciate it so much, Joe. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much. Again, Patrick Kennedy is the author of the new book, A Common Struggle, A Personal Journey Through the Past and Future of Mental Illness and Addiction. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.